for not having been here yesterday, actually, because the session was about chromatin, and I'm going to tell you about chromatin remodeling today, and I would certainly have liked to hear the talk of yesterday. So I'm sorry and apologize. So anyway, I will tell you about chromatin remodeling, and I hope that you had a good introduction yesterday on chromatin, so I'm not going to tell you about the importance of chromatin, but just on how it can be remodeled, how the distances between histones on the DNA can be modified by the action of chromatin remodeling factor, in particular ATP-dependent chromatin remodeling factor, and among them, this factor ICY. I will come back and describe that in more details in a few minutes. This work was the PhD work of Elise Prally, which was continued by Ding Fang Yuan. We had the results already a couple of years ago, but as you see, in terms of single molecule experiments, these are rather tough single molecule experiments, because what we observed was that this remodeling factor is actually has a very high cooperativity. Now, high cooperativity with single molecule experiments is very difficult to interpret and can yield to all kind of artifacts. So in order to make sure that we did not have artifacts and we understood what we were actually observing and interpreting, we contacted the group of Eric Lacam at Institut Gustave Roussy, who conducted an independent investigation using TEM of the interaction between ICY and chromatin remodeling factor. So what I'm going to tell you about today is about two types of single molecule experiments. One is manipulation experiments that we did, and the other one is the electron microscopy experiments where you observe the interaction between the DNA and the enzyme. But these are, of course, frozen static images, but they certainly complement and allow us to interpret what we see in the dynamics. So you have dynamics on manipulation, and you'll have TEM for observation, and the enzyme, of course, we got from Tom Owen Hughes at the University of Dundee, with whom we have been collaborating on this for quite a few sometimes. So I'm going to tell you about chromatin, or most of the remodeling factor, what are their role, in particular ICY, and we are quite lucky because the structure of ICY, the enzyme that we studied, was published very recently. I think it was Nature 2 weeks ago, something like that. So I'm going to tell you about the structure of ICY and actually how from that structure, towards the end of my lecture, I will tell you how actually we can understand our results in terms of that structure. I will then tell you something about the manipulation tool that we are using, the magnetic trap. And I will present our result, which concerns the cooperative binding of ICY on DNA and the translocation of nucleosome by ICY in the presence of ATP. Only in the presence of ATP. And then I will describe a model for how ICY translocate nucleosome on DNA, which is called tank chain conveyor belt model for translocation. So what is the role of chromatin remodeling factor? Well, you must have seen pictures like that already a few times. The chromatin in the nucleus is consists of DNA wound around histones, and these DNA wound around histones are very often quite compacted, and in order to give access to transcription factors, various enzymes, etc., the chromatin structure has to be loosened up. And the role of chromatin remodeling factors is somehow to determine the distance between nucleosomes and loosen up the structure, so that transcription factors can have access to DNA. Certain region can be more or less condensed. Can work both ways. They can help condense DNA or help on the other decondense DNA. And they do that by two ways. So they have a remodeling factor that modify histones by adding some covalent modifications on the histones. I'm not going to tell about those ones. And there are other chromatin remodeling factors that do not chemically modify DNA or histones, but they use ATP to actually translocate DNA on the surface of histone and therefore displace the distance between nearby histones on the DNA. And this is the chromatin remodeling factor I'm going to talk about today. So there is a whole class of these ATP-driven chromatin remodeling factors. There are two major classes, ICY and ICY-SNF family. These are a few names in man, in fly, in yeast. We have a few years ago studied, and not only we, but also other groups, Carlos has studied the RSC risk, combating antibody from the swine sniff family on yeast. We show that this remodeling factor acts as a single complex that can translocate DNA by making loops of DNA, and it can, by making loops of DNA on nucleosome, can also displace nucleosomes. ICY1, which is another factor from the ICY family of chromatin remodeling factors, has not been studied in single molecule experiments so far, and you'll see why in a second. It's quite a help to study this enzyme. There has been lots of studies of these enzymes, all of these enzymes actually, in bulk on very short pieces of DNA. Typically, the way that people do bulk experiments with chromatin remodeling factors is that they make single nucleosome DNA, so they have a single histone, and they wound around this histone, they wound a DNA molecule, which is about a few hundred base pairs, so 200 base pairs or something like that. And then they position the nucleosome at the center using one of the sequences that John developed, the family 601 sequence usually. And then by using, by interacting a chromatin remodeling factor with this construct, the people study where does the nucleosome, where is it being displaced? Towards the end of the segment, towards the middle of the segment, and that's how people have developed assays for characterization of remodeling of remodelers and studying their efficiency. The DNA substrate I'm going to study, and also both with single molecule and TMR, actually very long DNA substrates. So we have DNA substrates which are about a kb in length, and we have a single nucleosome centered when we use a nucleosome, a single nucleosome centered on that DNA, again using a 601 sequence. So it's a very long substrate, and I'm seeing that at the onset because, as you'll see in a second, this robotic factor is highly cooperative. It makes kind of fibers on the DNA. And this is something that you would not, of course, see if you use too short a DNA substrate. So this is the structure. So this enzyme that I'm going to tell you about is YSY. Y for yeast and ICY1. This enzyme for the ICY family in yeast. This is the structure of the enzyme without its ATPase unit. So this enzyme needs ATP to displace nucleosome. It did not crystallize with the ATPase unit, which is bound here. This is the N unit, this N terminal. So the ATPase is somewhere here. This is the unit without the ATPase, okay? And this unit was crystallized recently. This is the paper. And it consists of two subunits, ICE1 and LOG3. ICE1 is three motifs, hand, sand, and slide, which bind to DNA. So these three motifs bind to one strand of DNA, and LOG3 is another subunit with two motifs, CLB and HLB, which are also DNA binding motifs. So this enzyme can bind two segments or two different sites on DNA, and you'll see that indeed this is what happens. Now the structure with the DNA is shown here, again, from that paper. So this is the binding of DNA to the hand, sand, and slide segment, and this is binding of the other pieces of DNA to the CLB and presumably HLB, but they didn't have a long enough DNA to actually study this binding here. So this is, as I said, a partial crystallographic structure of the enzyme. But as you'll see from that structure and TM images of this complex, they could suggest a mechanism for how this enzyme would work as a single unit. And I'll describe it towards the end and try to connect that structure and this model with our observations. Okay, so this is the enzyme that we want to study. Okay, these enzymes, from these recent structures is supposed to bind to two DNA segments. And indeed, as you see, this is what we do observe. The technique that we are using, I told you, is we are using two techniques. One of them is DNA manipulation. The other one is TEM, electron microscopy. The DNA manipulation setup is very easy. You start with a DNA. Here it's a DNA hairpin, but it can be any DNA. This is quite standard by now. You label it at one end with biotin, at the other end with deoxygenin. You bind it to beads, like here. So these are streptavidin-coated beads to which this end binds. You inject that into a small capillary tube or a cell. And because the bead is heavier than water, it sediments. The other side of the DNA binds to the surface. You wash. This now is very, very standard. As you wash, all the beads that are unbound are being flushed away. Only this bead and a few other like it that are bound to the surface by the DNA remains bound. And this is what you are going to study. This whole thing sits on top of an inverted microscope. So this is the inlet, outlet. This is the cell. It consists of basically double scotch tape, which is sandwiched between a glass slide and a Mylar sheet. The Mylar sheet is very thin, about 10 microns. The scotch tape is about 50 microns. So you can bring the magnets. These are the magnets here. You can bring the magnets very close to your sample and exert a very high force.
And the other beads are interesting.
Sorry?
You've shown many beads.
Yeah. The other beads have been flushed away. The magnet was far away. You flush when the magnet is far away, and then you bring the magnet back close to the surface to pull on it, okay? So this setup allows you to actually pull on many beads simultaneously. So here you see two beads, for example, but nowadays we can monitor hundreds of beads simultaneously. So this is the cell, as I said before. This is a thermalized stage with a camera. And the camera allows us to look at the beads. So it's basically a very simple microscope, an objective, a camera, illumination with LED. And nowadays, this stuff is even now sold by company. So once you have a bead bound by DNA, the first thing you check is to characterize it. So you make sure that you have a single DNA or a single molecule binding your bead to the DNA. This is now standard things for the past 10 or 15 years. You first pull on the molecule, you measure the force extension. You verify that you observe something like the worm-like chain if it's double-stranded DNA. You can also twist the molecule. That's an advantage of magnetic traps. So by rotating the magnet, you twist the DNA, and as you twist the DNA, you form those plectonemes. And this is important if you want to test whether enzymes twist the DNA or not. So if you, and I'm telling that because this is one of the experiments I will tell you about in a second. So this is what you observe when you twist the DNA either positively or negatively. You form those plectonemes that you would form regularly on the cord. As you twist the cord, you would form those structures that you certainly have seen in telephone cords. If you pull on the DNA with a high force, about 0.5 piconewton, you start to denature the negatively supercoiled DNA. It melts. If you pull on it on the positive side with a force larger than about 3 or 4 piconewton, then you start to form another structure, an inside-out structure, which is known as pDNA, but it will not interest us here. What is important is to notice that this curve here of extension versus number of turn is symmetric, whether you twist it positively or negatively. At low force, you don't feel the chirality of the DNA. However, if an enzyme interacts with the DNA and supercoils it by one turn, positively or negatively, because of linking number conservation, if it winds DNA by one turn, it must, by plus one turn, it must add minus one turn of rise somewhere else. And therefore, these curves are shifted when enzymes interact with a given chirality with the DNA. these curves, which we call head curves, they are shifted one way or the other simply because when the enzymes interact with an unnicked DNA molecule, whatever change in chirality the enzymes makes on the DNA, it has to compensate by a rise somewhere else in the DNA. And the rise is what you are measuring here. So these curves are shifted, and the shift in those curves indicates that you have a chiral interaction between the protein and the DNA. Okay? Yes? No, there's no enzyme. Here there is no enzyme. Okay? Here I'm just describing bare DNA, but I'm telling you that in the presence of enzymes, these curves are shifted, and this is why we are interested in those curves. Okay? All right, so now with the enzymes. So here is an image of a sample where you have two beads that are bound by the DNA and hover above the surface, pulled by a given force, and you have two other beads, those two here, that are actually stuck to the surface and serve to us as reference beads. And then you characterize those DNA, you make sure that you have a single DNA binding to those beads, and now you add, you flash in the enzyme, the IcY, into your cell, and it starts to decrease the force. At high force, nothing happens, 1.7 piconewton. 1 piconewton, nothing much happens. This is the extension of one bead. So green is bead 1, red is bead 2. And at about 0.7 piconewton, suddenly you see that bead 1, its extension decreases rather strongly, whereas bead 2 remains totally irresponsive to the protein in solution. So that's typically an indication that your system is highly cooperative. If something nucleates on one DNA, then it will start to assemble on that DNA. The nucleation is a rather rare event. It will assemble on bead 1, but it will not assemble on bead 2. Okay? Now, if you increase the concentration of enzyme, then of course all the beads will get covered. And experiments like that, this is just one, but most of the experiments with this enzyme resulted in results like that, where you would have molecules that were irresponsive for a certain amount of time, and then they would see their extension decrease. So the reason that the extension decreases is that the enzyme interacts with the DNA and reduces its extension. Now, how does it interact with the DNA? How does it reduce its extension? Okay, we'll see that in a minute. Okay, but clearly here, the enzymes, only in the presence of the enzymes, and here without any ATP, is enough to actually reduce the extension from 1 micron to 0.3, and if you wait long enough, very close to the surface. So the enzyme, the DNA, is under attention. In spite of the fact that the DNA is under attention, work is being performed, or energy is being invested by the enzymes binding to the DNA and reducing its extension. Now, this is... No ATP. Just binding. This is just the energetics of binding of the enzyme to the DNA is sufficient to actually overcome the energy, the work against the force. Okay. The enzyme is very small. The enzyme is very small. It's picomolar. Yes.
So one DNA makes it all.
Well, don't forget that we have not one DNA. We are looking at one DNA, but in all the sample we have a million DNA or something like that. Okay. We are looking at 100 micron by 100 micron. This is our field of view. The cell is a few centimeters long.
What about nucleosomes? Are they already?
No nucleosomes.
Not yet.
This is bare DNA. Not yet. This is bare DNA, no ATP, no nucleosomes.
Okay?
We'll start slowly. We'll add things. So, okay, one interpretation, as I told you, is cooperative binding. So when we saw that, we wanted to make sure that what we were seeing was cooperative binding and not, I don't know, absorption of the DNA on the surface or something like that. So we asked Eric Lacam if he could look at DNA in presence of ICY low concentration, as we did. So this is linear pieces of DNA, no enzyme. And as you add enzyme, you see that there are molecules that have no enzyme on it, molecules with lots of enzyme on it. Here again, a molecule with no enzyme on it, and here a molecule that is coated with lots of enzymes on it. So again, the TM images seem to show that when the enzyme nucleates on the DNA, then it tends to recruit more and more enzymes until they coat the whole DNA molecule. So what we do observe, and these are just a few of the figures, but what we do observe with TM, just like we observed with the manipulation experiments, is that a few molecules are free of enzymes, and other molecules are completely coated with them. It's not that you have something in between, or you have one enzyme here and there. So it's really a hallmark of cooperative or first order transition, if you would like, in terms of physics. So that's, for a single molecule experiment, that's something of a problem, because then you don't have a single molecule. You have many molecules on your DNA, and it's very difficult to characterize how many molecules you have and what these molecules are doing on the DNA. So very, very rarely, by increasing the force, by pulling on the DNA, you of course reduce the probability of nucleation, because the work that the enzymes has to do when binding to DNA is increased. And therefore, by pulling on the DNA, you can basically remove these remodeling factors. And you can get sometimes with appropriate concentration of enzymes and appropriate forces to a point where you do sometimes see kind of telegraphic noise, where you have single nucleation event that they don't last long enough to actually induce more, and you see some kind of telegraphic noise like that. Okay, so if you see something like that, it is interesting, because at least you have a way to measure the change in the DNA extension when a single enzyme is interacting with the DNA, which is very rarely observed. Most of the time you see the traces I showed you before. So from traces like that, you can deduce a given extension for a change in extension or an amount of DNA that is bound by one of those enzymes that is binding to DNA. Another thing you can also do is that if you start with a DNA that is being coated with enzymes, you can then pull on it and monitor how the extension increases each time you eject one complex. And this is a kind of steps that you observe. Again, here the distance is about 28 nanometer, which is not too far from what you measure with the steps. So these are, you can then with on many such signal, you can build histograms of the kind of steps that you do observe. And from the histogram of the step, that tells you how much DNA is absorbed, how much the DNA is complexed with the chromatin remodeling factor each time a complex interacts with the DNA. And it's about 28 nanometer. Now, how does it interact? Our model that I will show you at the end is that we have kind of a zipper structure where one enzyme bends the DNA, and from then on more are being recruited and forming a single zipper-like structure, the enzyme binding to two strands of the DNA. Now, with the structure of the enzyme, we know that indeed the enzyme is capable of binding to two segments of the DNA. So it makes sense that if you have an enzyme binding to two segments, more would be able to be recruited and continue to bind, and therefore form this long zipper-like structure. This is a trace where each line like that represents one complex binding. And the thing which is also interesting is that this binding and unbinding is a very dynamical process. You see here, there is the noise that you see here is not experimental noise. This is binding unbinding of the enzyme from the DNA. The noise that you see in the experiment is much, much smaller. It's more closer to what you see here. So, again, you can do that with the TM, and in particular, you can test whether the enzyme would preferentially binds to DNA that which is supercoiled, namely where already two segments are close to each other. Supercoiled DNA, two nearby segments in the DNA are very close, and therefore you expect that on supercoiled DNA molecule to be easier to nucleate and easier to generate this zipper-like structure. So this is a controlled DNA. You have linear pieces and you have supercoiled pieces together. The linear pieces are simply supercoiled pieces being cut. And what you see here is that when you have enzymes, the enzymes bind to the supercoiled structure but don't bind to the linear pieces. These are supercoiled structures, this is the linear pieces. They bind to the supercoil but don't bind to the linear. Okay? Again, it is easier to nucleate, and from the nucleation point, you generate whole fiber, whole complex of enzymes on supercoiled DNA, but not on linear DNA. That is clearly seen in the TM, and it is also seen in the experiments. What we have here is that we have, again, our sample with two beads, one in which the DNA is nicked, and one in which the DNA is not nicked. A DNA that is nicked, if you rotate the bead, you cannot form supercoil. So it's very easy to identify. You simply twist, you rotate your magnets. If the bead recoils to the surface, the DNA is not nicked. If the bead does not recoil to the surface, does not form plectonemes, then the DNA is nicked. So it's very easy to the test, nick, not nicked, is trivial in this type of experiments. So what you do then is you start with two beads, one nicked, one not nicked, that you found in your sample, two DNA bound to two different beads, one nicked and one unnicked DNA, and you start to rotate the magnets. When you rotate them by five turns, we don't supercoil the DNA. At this force, five turns, you twist the DNA, but you don't form writhe. And therefore, you have a slight change in extension maybe here, but no formation of supercoils, and you see that the structure does not, and you don't have a reduction in the extension of the DNA due to its interaction with the raw modeling factors that are present in solution. However, once you start to make supercoil at plus 10 turns, we know that from the curves I showed you before, these head curves, we know that at plus 10 turns, the DNA starts to form supercoil, starts to writhe. Then the nicked DNA, nothing happens, no formation of ICY complexes. On the unnicked DNA, you have strong formation of complexes, and the extension of the molecule decreases dramatically. Okay, so once you buckle, at the moment that the DNA molecule buckles, what it forms writhe, nucleation points exist on the DNA on which the ICY can nucleate, and once you have a nucleation on the DNA, the rest of the fiber of ICY is generated. Now, the question that we asked ourselves is, okay, so we know that the ICY can bind to two segments, that it can, it's enough to actually link to DNA and can polymerize on it or form a long complex. Does it twist the DNA when it does that? In order to test whether it twists DNA when it does that, we looked at the formation of a complex on a positively and a negatively supercoiled DNA. And by looking at how the curve is being shifted when we look at formation of a complex by turning the DNA by plus 6 turn or minus 6 turn, we could deduce that there was no chiral induction of ICY on the DNA. Okay, so ICY binds to the DNA but does not twist it. Okay. It really like a zipper. It binds the two segments, one next to each other. Now, last thing that we did, and this is we did with the TEM, we could look at nucleosomes with tweezers, But a nucleosome that is being displaced on the DNA has no measurable effect with magnetic traps. If the nucleosome is here or it is there, it will not change anything in the extension of the molecule, which is what we are actually measuring. So if you want to see that, you would need to use fluorescence or things of that sort. And what we did actually was using the TEM to actually observe how a nucleosome is being displaced by the presence of ICY. So how do we do that? You start with the DNA with a single nucleosome here. Okay, so you have a single nucleosome positioned at a well-defined place using the CO601 sequence developed by John Widom. So you make a DNA like that with a positioning sequence. You bind a nucleosome on that sequence. You characterize your molecule to make sure that all your molecules are indeed like that. You know you have two DNA with two different extensions. You add ICY, and you see that ICY is actually bringing those two DNAs close to each other, like they are zipping them. Okay, the nucleosome is still here. And then you add ATP, and you look, you measure the change in extension, the difference between this chain and that chain. And you see that the nucleosome, whereas it was here, the chain are very close to each other, more at the center, the nucleosome has been displaced. Okay, so you can do the statistics. This is what you observed in the ICY control plus ATP. What is this? ICY minus ATP, and with ATP is the red. So the nucleosome with the ICY and ATP is in the red. This is what you observe. So the chain, you do observe the displacement, a random movement of ICY along the DNA. Okay. So in spite of the fact that you have a complex, you have this whole coating of the DNA by these ICY complexes, the nucleosome is still capable of being translocated. Okay, you would imagine that once you have the two DNA that are completely zipped, it will be impossible to displace the nucleosome. Well, it is being displaced, and the reason is that actually these remodeling factor could act like a conveyor belt. Okay, so this is the structure from this paper, this recent paper in Nature. This is the model that they propose for how a single nucleosome, this is what they study. They study a single nucleosome. What most people usually study is a single nucleosome could actually translocate DNA. So the idea is that this nucleosome interacts with these two strands, and with the ATPase unit here, it could actually translocate the DNA from that size here to the other size of the ATP. Okay, I'm not going to go into the details of that. They suggest two different models, either direct translocation or bending of the DNA. Never mind. But you can imagine that you have these complexes now bound to each other, and actually the distances between this, the change in extension that we measure would suggest that we have actually a dimer of these nucleosome. And if you have a dimers in opposite opposite to each other, then the ATPase here would drive the DNA along this direction, the ATPase here would drive the DNA in that direction, and what you have here actually is really a conveyor belt. So the cooperative action of all these enzymes would actually not hinder each other, but actually would be enough to actually translocate maybe even very efficiently the DNA on the nucleosome, and therefore displace the nucleosome with respect to the DNA. So here I'm finishing. The conclusion is that ICY bridges DNA without ATP. It is very cooperative. It really zips the two strands of the DNA. But in the presence of ATP, it can translocate actually a nucleosome on the DNA. And therefore, this ICY can act as a chromatin remodeling factor, but with a rather peculiar mechanism of translocation. Thank you. Yes? The microphone.
Questions, please? Boris?
So when you were talking about cooperativity of enzymes on DNA, Several times you mentioned the word nucleation, mm-hmm. but nucleation is kinetics. Mm-hmm. What I envision in what you said is that this is thermodynamics phenomenon. This is not nucleation phenomenon. And my understanding is cooperativity comes from the fact that if first guy enters, it should bend DNA.
Sure.
Second guy enters for free.
Sure. Well, for free. No, it's not for free. It's not for free well, because it also it has to. There's
lower,
a force against it, and it has
lower,
to.
Easier.
It's like a nucleation phenomenon.
This is not.
It's like nucleation. If you have supercooled water, and you want to form ice, you have to nucleate.
Yeah, I know.
It's exactly the same thing.
No.
Why not? It's exactly the same. It costs a certain energy to nucleate, and from then on.
Actually, you didn't mention about directionality of the motion, because you showed that the things are moving. What?
This is simply by. You can take the mirror image of that, and instead of having translocation this way, you have translocation the other way.
If you want to move histones farther apart, how they decide about directionality? Because you need to move one histone one way, the other to the other way.
In this model, only one histone is being displaced, and basically what happens is that the histones are being displaced toward each other, and this is what determines the distance. This cooperative assembly acts like a ruler with a given number of ticks, the ticks being the number of from other
Okay. Ralph, we'll get the microphone to you.
Just for this picture here, so if you now pull the DNA like a conveyor belt, mm-hmm. shouldn't that have the effect on the nucleosome that it just drops out? I mean, it's like a corkscrew.
Yeah, well...
And then it's gone.
Well, it's gone, or it's displaced. Yeah, it's gone. It's gone. I mean, the DNA moves on the nucleosome, so the nucleosome is displaced along the DNA.
Doesn't it fall out?
Why fall? No. It's exactly like the DNA is being pulled this way and taken out that way. So you know, you have imagine that you have a pulley here, and you are moving the DNA on the pulley.
Yeah. Okay. So, what I imagine is that this is like a corkscrew, like a screw.
Yes, sure.
And then if you do this, then the screw would slowly move in the plane or out of the plane. Now that screw has the particular property of being rather short. So
No. It is not ejecting the histone. It's simply moving on the surface. So what thing that enters is being translocated to the other. So the nucleosome would rotate or would accommodate the DNA on the top, but nothing would.
But your experiment was made with one histone.
With
right?
one histone.
Only one histone.
Right.
And so it's probably, I mean, that's what they see, right? Okay, next question to Volgotsky, please.
So it looks like your protein. Exactly. Does it work? Oh, yeah. Your protein binds DNA in non-sequence specific way, yeah?
No.
How it is compatible with its biological function?
Sorry?
It's not. How this is compatible with its biological function?
It is not. It is non-specific. This chromatin binding factor is very is non-sequence specific.
So you cannot. Promoters have to be activated.
But usually they are recruited. They are non-sequence specific, but they are recruited to where they are being used by other factors that are sequence specific. But it's like topoisomerase, right?
Essentially interact with other proteins. Which
in vivo, sure.
But in your case also,
how they
find a histone? Finally,
sorry?
How they find a histone? They're soaked somewhere, and then they diffuse to the histone and move it?
The point is that next to the histone, you have two DNA segments that are close to each other, which would tend to promote binding of the rhodopsin factor close to the histone in our setup.
Yeah. Okay, sure, please.
Again, about your bead one and bead two in the beginning of your your experiment. Mm-hmm. I forgot which one was which. Bead one went down.
Sure.
Do you mean that if we wait long enough, then bead two will eventually also go down? Or is it an equilibrium situation that one of them went down and the other?
It depends. It depends on how long you want to wait. It depends on how much protein you have. Because as I told you, there are much DNA in the sample, and the DNA that you have in the sample can simply lower the concentration of absorb all the histones. But if you have other remodeling factors, if you have enough remodeling factors, yes, you're right. Then everything will collapse to the.
Sure, sure.
This is where you have to actually play with the concentration of remodeling factors, not to have collapse of everything to the surface.
Yeah. As a follow-up to this discussion, to Shura's question, did you actually look at the concentration dependence of this hysteresis on concentration of remodeling factors? Because that will give you the idea of the interaction of remodeling factor interaction.
It's very, 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 very tricky. It's very because it depends very sensitively on. You see, we are working with picomolar concentrations of enzymes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some of these, it's very difficult in this experiment to control precisely the concentration. So picomolar is the upper level because some of them may absorb on the surface or in the tubes that you are using. So once you increase, you start, let's say, with 10 picomolar, mm-hmm. and then you double the concentration, you see nothing, you double another time, and then suddenly
they aggregate,
and very often it's tricky to find the concentration where they not everything falls to the surface where you have.
Right, but around picomolar concentration, for example, if you double it, say, from 1 picomolar to 2 picomolar, and see how this quantitative dependence, so wait time for bid one to go down, how would it change quantitatively?
We have tried that, but not successfully because of the high sensitivity mm-hmm. to you see nothing, and you say, well, nothing happened, so I'm going to add a little bit more, and then when you add a little bit more, then suddenly.
Okay.
So
there will be a last question while the microphone is moving. I want to ask you another thing about you. The main diagnostic tool here was TEM, right?
Yeah.
So could you give some details about how the TEM was performed? What the temperature was?
It was all performed at room temp. The TEM, the way that you do TEM images is that you assemble remodeling factors with the DNA in a test tube. Mm-hmm. Then you spread them on the grid.
Yeah.
You coat them with uranyl salt to be able to see the DNA and the proteins, and you look at them
How much are you sure that the substrate doesn't interfere, because you have to put it on some surface,
you,
right?
You put it on a substrate. You put it on a substrate. Again, I'm not. I didn't do the experiments on the TEM. Lecam is an expert in TEM microscopy and in DNA, has a lot of experience in looking at DNA structures. So if you want details on how to do that, you should really ask him about that.
But you essentially have this distance diagnostics without any TEM, right?
Right. So the whatever artifacts can exist in TEM would be certainly very different from the artifacts that we have.
Sure.
In our setup.
The last question, please.
So can you tell if there's feedback from tension, if there's tension on the DNA on the reaction mechanism of ISY?
In our experiments?
Yeah.
Yes, with the magnetic trap, of course, there is a feedback, or an influence, not feedback is the bad word, but an influence of the force that you are putting on the DNA on the ISY. In particular, if you pull more than about 1 or 1.5 piconewton, then you rarely see or never see a formation of this ISY fiber. Okay, so you have to be at low force to be able to see the formation of this ISY fiber.
So thank you very much. We proceed to the second talk of Tiny Liverpool.